This is Rabbi G, and welcome to Harvard God and Gen Z. The goal of this podcast is to discuss life's big questions with some of America's brightest young minds. We will discuss Harvard's continued sway on the imagination as the peak of success. We will discuss how to get there and what it is like when you do. We will then shift to discuss if and in what ways meaning and God are relevant features of Gen Z. What better place than Harvard for discussing these issues with the thought leaders of tomorrow?
Welcome back, everybody. We have an exciting guest here today, the first person from Grand Rapids, Michigan, maybe the last, we'll see. But we are here with Daniel Slaw, senior at Harvard College, majoring in economics with a citation in Russian. Was just in Russia, but cut short by the pandemic, unfortunately. But anyway, welcome, Daniel. Exciting to have you here. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast. How are you?
Thank you. Excellent. Tell us a little bit about Grand Rapids. Did you come from an academic family? Was education really pushed? How in the world did you get to Harvard from Grand Rapids? Is that a common path over there?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely not that common of a path. My high school never really emphasized kids going to top schools like Harvard or Ivies or even Ivy-like schools in general. They were very much focused on the Michigan school. So it's kind of very much on my own that I wanted to get to Harvard. And yeah, I mean, I think my family's not super academic or anything. I mean, my mom has a master's degree actually in Judaic studies. But apart from that, you know, they just have bachelor degrees and you know, none of them had ever really gone to, you know, a fantastic university like Harvard. And so, yeah, it was really a goal on my own, but
Where did that goal get implanted? You saw a movie, you just knew Harvard was the best and you were competitive. Where did that drive come from to get there? How was that implanted in your brain?
I would say going into high school, I was pretty good friends with a group of boys who were kind of just very much had this idea of talking about these top schools for some reason. I'm not sure exactly why, but, you know, I was friends with them and as a result kind of got pulled along with, you know, thinking about these schools, even figuring out these schools exist.
And do you guys push each other academically or did you guys motivate each other?
I'd say there was probably some motivation, but probably also some kind of competition as well. And just that these boys wanted to get to these schools. And I think their parents were much more so trying to push them to go there. Whereas my parents were very much where you can do whatever you want to do. You know, if you want to take this class, go ahead and do it. If you want to do this. Sure thing.
You know, so we're going to ask you an honest question now. Ready?
Sure.
How much was your drive based on ego and how much was it based on intellectual excellence and curiosity? Because it wasn't coming from your parents. So where was that drive coming from?
Yeah, I think it was really a lot of things. I think one aspect of it is just kind of following a natural strength in that I had always thought that maybe some intellectual academic things were where I thrived. You know, growing up, I was always a very shy kid, wasn't very confident, didn't necessarily have a ton of friends. And so I think one of the things that stuck out in my mind was, oh, I'm pretty good at school, pretty good at doing well in these courses. It's probably a good thing to continue trying to do well in these courses. I mean, I liked learning everything that I was learning. It was all just very interesting to me. So I think there is that aspect of it, of just clinging on to something that I thought I was good at and that made me feel good, whereas I was lacking in all these other areas. So I think that was one aspect of it. Another aspect was just that going into my high school, my parents had divorced. They had actually lost their jobs. Our house was actually foreclosed on. And as a result, you know, I saw my family struggling a lot and really was trying to figure out, okay, you know, I know I need to go to college. How exactly can I go to college for free? And then I started looking into the financial aid policies of these top schools and surprisingly figured out that, you know, if you can get into one of these schools and your family makes under a certain income, then you can actually go for pretty much for free, and they'll, you know, pay for everything pretty much. So I think that was also another really big aspect of it, is just that, you know, I wanted to be able to provide for my family when I'm older and really be able to make sure they didn't have any debt and just, you know, do what I could to really ensure that the family could go where it needs to go.
Wow, so that had a two-pronged benefit. One, a cheap college for now, and more or less, not always guaranteed, but definitely the Harvard name is definitely a good start to make sure that you do succeed in life and don't face a little bit. That must have been a really difficult. Did you understand what was going on when your house was being foreclosed? Was it really jarring for you?
Yeah, I mean, I've looked back and, you know, I don't think I fully really understood it. I just knew that money was always, you know, a concern, as in always looking for how to get a good deal, or even just collecting soda cans to be able to return them for, you know, the 10 cent deposit. You know, I think just observing my mom throughout the years, she was always very frugal, and, you know, seeing that she wasn't really spending money on things she didn't really need, you know, wasn't an extravagant spender by any means, always very close to the books. And yeah, I mean, I just wanted to be able to contribute in any way that I could. And I figured, you know, by doing well in school and by trying to get into one of these top schools, then, you know, that was something that I could do to try to benefit her.
Amazing. And when you found out, what was the reaction?
Oh, it was, you know, it was over the moon. I actually have the video of me telling my mom, and it's just, I just look back at it, and it's just one of the most beautiful moments of seeing her realize that I got in, and, you know, we both started crying. It was just a wonderful moment.
And now, having gone to Harvard, has it lived up to its promise?
Yeah, I mean, more and less. It's Harvard's an interesting place, especially coming from a place like Grand Rapids, Michigan, where, you know, not a lot of kids from my high school go to Harvard. The last one who went to Harvard was 4 years before me, so didn't really know what it was like. The last kid who went to Harvard from my high school was 4 years before me, so really didn't know anything about Harvard, didn't know what to expect, didn't know anyone at Harvard, and so kind of went into it with fresh open eyes. And I mean, it was very, very startling at the start, at least, because there's this process at Harvard to join clubs called the comp process. And so a lot of clubs I wanted to join, you actually have to apply and do interviews and, you know, give them exactly what they want in the interview. And I didn't really know any of those things. And so it was a little bit crushing at the start, actually, just to apply to these clubs, get rejected, you know, start taking college courses and not necessarily doing as well as I was doing in high school. So it can be a bit of a startling experience, but, you know, over time, I think you find your people, it gets better, you understand how to actually do the courses, you figure out things that interest you, you know, you figure out how to be a young adult.
And what would you tell people that are trying to get into Harvard? What advice do you have? How did you succeed in high school? What made you stick out that helped you get to the top?
Yeah, I would say just be curious and pursue your interests as much as possible. I'd say that's really what I was doing, was just, you know, just following whatever I was interested in. And my classes for me, you know, I'd come home and I'd kind of just immediately do my homework, because I guess for some reason I just had that discipline, but I also just wanted to, you know, get through the problem just so I could get to the next lesson. And so just being curious and trying to follow as much as what you're interested in about, I think will just lead you to a lot of good places.
You mentioned that getting to Harvard, once you were there, was quite complicated with all the competitive drives, and it kind of never ends. So there's always that next step, that rat race towards, okay, what can I come to next? Do you find that affects the overall happiness and well-being of many students at Harvard?
Yeah, I actually think it's a huge problem. And I mean, to an extent, I think it's also a result of the education system too. And just that a lot of people get to Harvard, right? And they were kind of going after that shiny thing, which is getting accepted into Harvard. And then they get there and they have to figure out, I need a new goal. I have to go after the next shiny thing. And I think a lot of people, they're trying to get to Harvard, and that's their big goal, right? Their prestigious thing they're going for. And then they get in, right? And then they have to figure out what's, you know, what's my next goal, in that they kind of just delayed actually what they want to do in their life, or, you know, they weren't able to reflect on it enough. And then, you know, they see what all their other peers are thinking about at Harvard, and they're thinking about the going into investment banking or going into consulting or trying to get a job at a big tech company like Google or Apple or Amazon, because it's just the next prestigious thing to do. And it also provides a lot of optionality, right? And if you have options, then, you know, you're able to, you know, you don't have to feel so confident or know 100% that you want to be an investment banker for the rest of your life, because it provides optionality, right? And so I think a lot of people are just, you know, get really sucked into that and never really stop to think about if it's something that would actually be good for them to do, or they're necessarily interested in doing it. And I think they just don't realize there's a lot of other possibilities and a lot of other options out there, and they just get sucked into the rat race. And you know, sometimes they...
So what's the solution to the rat race in your mind? How do people stop just living for the next goal? What's the opposite of that? How do you move away from that?
Yeah, I think to an extent, a lot of it is what I was saying before about just being curious and pursuing your interests. And, you know, if you keep doing that, I think you end up honing in on something that you'd enjoy doing for the rest of your life, or at least something that you'd enjoy doing for a few years, or that you find meaning in. You know, you kind of figure out what your strengths are, figure out your interests are, figure out what society needs, and then try to figure out how all three of those kind of intersect. And I think you get there just by being curious and, you know, figuring out more about yourself and your interests, but then also figuring
out... What if your interests lead to something that you don't make enough money, or the money you thought you would make leaving Harvard? How do you balance that?
Well, I think that goes to the values that someone has, in that do they think that making a lot of money is the most important thing for them, or do they think that other things are more important? And to go back about the rat race before, I think a lot of it goes back to kind of this idea of having eulogy values and just having like the moment-to-moment values, and that, you know, these eulogy values, or as other people might describe it, as like a hidden scorecard of life, in that, you know, when you're 80 and you're looking back on your life, are you really going to care about how much money you made? Or, you know, that you got this investment banking role or this consulting role or things like that? You know, there's, I think, a lot of people when they're 80, and when people are talking about people who are 80 and they're looking back at their lives, they're thinking, you know, was this person a good person? Were they kind? Did they try to help others? Were they humble? Were they, you know, not humble? All of these things. And I think just a lot of people fail to take that perspective. And, you know, I think part of that is just a short-term perspective on life, and people don't think about the long-term enough, and they're just trying to optimize over the short-term, where, you know, life to an extent is long, or at least the average lifespan is fairly long. And, you know, if you're trying to maximize your life, I think you try to maximize over the long-term as opposed to the short-term.
I agree. But even you mentioned kind of one of the impetuses for you to go to Harvard was just for that financial stability. So in that case, how do you, even in that situation where it's very merited, you know, growing up with financial difficulty is a great motivator, say, I don't want that. Is that, does that play into also just pursuing your interests?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, another part that was great about being able to go to Harvard is that I had no idea what I wanted to study. And I mean, to an extent, when I was a sophomore and had to choose my major, it was like high school all over again, in that I had no idea what I wanted to choose as my major. And so, you know, being able to go to Harvard, I knew all the departments were pretty fantastic, that all of the departments do have just wonderful professors and faculty in them. And so, you know, I was able to, I guess, you know, give myself a little bit of optionality, or at least know that I could choose something and, you know, there'd still be great professors to learn from.
You mentioned your values. So where did your values come from growing up? How important were Jewish values, perhaps specifically growing up? How did those shape you?
Yeah, I'm not sure how values necessarily develop in a person, or at least someone who is, you know, a teenager or even before that too. I think a lot of it is people learn from example. there's this philosopher, Rene Girard, and I've been meaning to read him, but he's pretty known for coming up with mimetic theory, and that I think the premise of it is that a lot of humans are basically just mimicking everything that's going on in society and in culture. And so I think a lot of it is you learn from your examples. And I think for me, at least, that was my parents, my mom specifically. She was always an extremely hard worker. And that was something that was just very formative to me, seeing her working hard. She didn't have the greatest job and was just working a ton of hours. And, you know, she never really complained about it either. She kind of just took it with stride and just continued working because, you know, that was the only thing she could really do at the time. And, you know, she had a family to support. And so you just have to keep working. And so I saw a lot of hard work from her, but then I also saw a lot of kindness from her as well, in that, you know, if we had some just like junk in our house that we needed to get rid of, it was never just, oh, throw this away. It was, okay, can we give this to someone, or can we donate it to Goodwill, or can we, you know, do something else that, you know, this item can still be used again. And so also just having a perspective like that. And, you know, she was always just very kind to her friends as well. And so seeing how to be a good friend from her. Another thing that I learned from her was just, you know, like committing to something and actually doing it. And I mean, this is just a lot of times in my childhood, she'd want me to try something, whether it was ballet or hip hop dance or baseball or something along those lines. And, you know, maybe after the first 2 weeks of doing it, I wouldn't want to continue to do it. But she would say, you made a commitment to do this for however long it was, whether it be 6 months or a year. And, you know, I would just live up to that commitment because she was so insistent on it. And I think that's just a really great thing to have, in that if you're going to make a promise, you have to maintain it and, you know, be a reliable person and a responsible person as well. So to go back to the original question, I think a lot of it is just observing from examples. And I also read a lot as a kid, so I think there is plenty of examples from books as well.
Could that be a dangerous philosophy, obviously, given that if your examples or, you know, the society around you has gone sour and you're just imitating the society around you, how does someone prevent themselves from just falling into any morality or any values that even ones that, much as far as you can tell, are actually negative? Is there any place for finding solid values that are independent of imitation?
As in somebody generates their, like completely generates their own values.
Or gets their values from somewhere else apart from what they're seeing around them, not just a product of their societies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I mean, everybody lives in a society, right? And the society is going to influence you no matter what. And so I don't think you can fully independently come up with your own values. I think some part of them must come from, you know, what you're seeing around you, what you're reading, what you're watching on TV, what your friends are saying, what your parents are saying. All of those things, I think, come together to form values. And then, I mean, I think to an extent, sure, there's your own reflection on things, but you're reflecting on what you've been experiencing in society. And so, yeah, I mean, you can't really get away from it, at least in my opinion.
So to be clear, we're somewhat condemned to kind of adopt the values of the society around us. And that's just what it is. And that's what's going to look right to us. And that's what we'll live out to some extent.
I don't know if it's condemned to the values around you, because, right, you can still explore other values that you're not necessarily seeing. You know, you can read the Torah, you can read the Bible, the Quran, and you can see what all of these, right, these former societies were doing, or how they tried to live their lives, and you can read about history and so on. And so, I mean, you can gather your values from a variety of places. I think it's just a matter.
And when you're kind of gathering the values from other places, what is it about a value you think that resonates? All of a sudden, you see a value and you say, "Oh, that sounds right." Like when you say that sounds right. Like, what are you saying? Because why should it sound right, more right than before? You know, a different value. Where does that come from in your mind?
I think to an extent, a lot of it comes from. Well, it depends on what the person is trying to optimize for, right? And that goes. So it's kind of a question of like the chicken or the egg, right? Because you have some values in your mind, and then you read about another value and think that's a good value, but where do those original values come from, right? So I think to an extent, some of that is probably biology, and that you're maximizing for survival, or maximizing for, right, your offspring to get produced. And then I think, yeah, the rest of it is whatever values were kind of ingrained in you as a child that have withstood the 10 years or, you know, however many years since your childhood, and just seeing the examples. And yeah, I mean, I think when you're a child, you're just getting all of these experiences, and kind of subconsciously values are forming. And then kind of as you grow up, more of these come to light, or at least you start reflecting more on them and figuring out, are these values actually what I want to have as my values? Or,
you know, so you said when you want to have these values, like, what's the, why would you want or not want the value? What would be determining that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you decide what kind of life you want to have, what kind of person you want to be, and you find values that, you know, I think would get you there, or, you know, try to live a meaningful life, right? Or if you're trying to live the happiest life.
What would you define as a meaningful life versus a happier life? What's the difference between the two? Are they the same? What makes something meaningful in your mind?
Yeah, it's a hard question. I think
we only ask hard questions here on the podcast.
I think something meaningful is it's really hard to define, because happiness is kind of just in the moment, right? It's fleeting. And there's this one quote where, you know, as soon as you think you're happy, then you're no longer happy, because you realize it, right? And so if you're just pursuing happiness, you'll just get on the hedonic treadmill, the hedonistic treadmill, and just try to maximize pleasure, whereas pleasure will end up being temporary, and then you'll just want more and more of it. And so it's just kind of this loop that never ends. Whereas meaning is probably much more of a lifelong kind of satisfaction, just over the span of your life, and that what you've done in your life or what you're doing in your life adds, positive value to the world, or helps other people, or does something greater than yourself, right? I think there's lots of ways people can find meaning. And it's hard to kind of pin down it to just one definition.
Yeah, what people say that impacting others makes something meaningful. What is meaningful about that? Whether I've impacted someone else or impacted myself, what makes impacting person A as opposed to impacting just myself more meaningful?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe a follow-up. Do you believe, does God play me a role, or does having God or believing in God play a role in being able to create meaning? Is meaning dependent on there being a God behind the world, or can meaning just be any goal that you set your mind to and has nothing to do with a more cosmic vision?
Yeah, so to answer the first question, I think a lot of meaning comes from helping others more so than yourself, because yourself is just a very limited point of view, and humans are very social creatures, in that if all you're doing is benefiting yourself, I think most people would get kind of dissatisfied with that pretty quickly. Or, I mean, or if you are just maximizing your own benefit, you're going to have a huge ego and people aren't going to like you, and then you'll die and you'll realize, what did I actually do, right? You didn't contribute anything except just maximizing your own happiness or your own benefit. And so, I mean, there's just an intrinsic kind of feeling of dissatisfaction by only doing that. Whereas if you help one person, you can really help a lot of other people as well, as can be a kind of a positive chain effect.
And is the meaning there the fact that you're transcending yourself? By when you help others, in a way, you're putting yourself into somebody else, and therefore your sense of self is beyond you, and that's what makes it meaningful. It's longer lasting. It's transcendent in a way. That's the meaning of it.
I think to an extent there's an idea of of the connectedness of everything and people and connectedness, yeah, just human to human, but also like humans to nature as well, and kind of the universe as a whole. And so I think when you're only focused on yourself, I think there's something about you that kind of knows this connectedness is not being fulfilled. And whereas if you help other people, you know, you're putting more positivity into the world and making the world more connected in a way that benefits more people.
When you say connected world, connected, that's in a metaphysical sense. There's some invisible connection between us, because as bodies, we're all obviously separate bodies. Is there something, what is connecting us in your mind?
Yeah, I think it's something metaphysical. I think some people might define it as love. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what it is and how exactly it works, but I think to an extent it's definitely there. And I think it's a common theme throughout a lot of things. I mean, you hear about people who go through medicinal psilocybin treatments and some of the things they talk about, and you know, these people are coming in with depression or substance abuse issues or other disorders, and they go through some psilocybin treatments, and you know, you're seeing people who after 6 months of one treatment, they're, you know, 80% are remission free from depression, which are just outstanding results. And you see what they say, the trip kind of helped them realize, or the treatment helped them realize. And a lot of them talk about love. A lot of them talk about the oneness of everybody being kind of centered together in togetherness, and that how everything is connected. And, you know, the universe kind of acts in mysterious ways, and you know, there's various mysterious laws or facts about the universe that don't really make sense. And I just think everything is connected in some way.
And to that second question, did you grow up with the concept of God in your house growing up? Was that something that was talked about? And how does God impact what we're discussing, or does the concept not impact it?
Yeah, so I mean, I grew up going to Hebrew school on Sunday, and I had a bar mitzvah, but I'd
say... Were those very God-focused places?
I wouldn't say they were super God-focused. It was, you know, it was a Reform synagogue for the most part. So I'd say my Jewish education wasn't very strong at all. And the concept of God was always something that was just very much too abstract for me, and that, you know, in my courses, I was learning about science and you know, chemistry and physics. And so those aspects were always just much more concrete in my mind. And the kind of abstract idea of God was always something that just seemed very, very far away from myself. And it's only since I've actually started to explore it myself that I've been seeing how it can be much more concrete, or at least can play a much bigger role in someone's life. And also just how, but you know, both sides can go hand in hand with each other as well.
What do you mean by both sides?
Well, just there, I mean, I think God and science can work together, that it doesn't necessarily have to be a dichotomy, or you could call it a false dichotomy.
How did you resolve that for yourself? What made you realize that?
Yeah, I mean, I think to an extent there's a lot of wisdom in the quote of, you know, the older the question, the older the answer. And a lot of the questions that people think about in their lives, about meaning, about purpose, about, you know, what you know, why is there something rather than nothing? People have been having these questions for thousands of years. And so I think there's a lot of wisdom to looking back at religion that has stood the test of time and provided people with answers to some of these questions, to, you know, to study those texts and to see what they have to say, and then trying to work together with what modern science says these days and kind of see how they relate together.
What's the most convincing argument for you personally? You know, you're saying that old religions had answers to these. Any of those answers speak to you particularly?
I mean, and answers to what? Of
to why is there something rather than nothing, the idea of a God, existing, not existing. Any argument for you resonate?
Well, I think to an extent in thinking about how to live a meaningful life and and what that even means. I think religion, or at least what I've learned from Judaism, provides a playbook on how to do that. And, you know, when you have a set of guiding principles and you can understand why, you know, why these principles are there and what they mean and how they can lead to a meaningful life, then it kind of lays out for you how, you know, how to do that yourself and, you know, how to be a righteous person and all of those things.
What are some of those principles that you found have been helpful or that speak to you?
So I think some of them is just, or at least one of them is getting away from maybe your evolutionary instincts, and just that, you know, you, if you just fall into what your biology is telling you, you know, you want food or you want sex or, you know, you want any of these things and you just succumb to those biological urges, then you're only satisfying, as we were talking about yesterday, you're only satisfying kind of one part of yourself, of just your evolutionary self. And I think humans, modern humans at least, are much more than that. And if you just succumb to doing that, you'll end up ultimately dissatisfied or end up as a nihilist.
And do you believe that you are just a product of evolution, or do you believe that you have what one would call maybe a soul or some non-physical dimension to who you are?
Yeah, it's a tough question. And definitely there's some product of evolution, but then, you know, you go back to what caused evolution, you go back to why does the universe exist, why did the Big Bang happen, or, you know, why, I think in the book, Why Is There Something Rather Than Nothing, the author concludes, after talking to a bunch of philosophers, scientists, biologists, you know, he kind of concludes that the universe or the Big Bang exists because of metaphysics. But why do metaphysics exist? You know, and to an extent, a lot of these things, a lot of the questions about science, we pursue further and further, but we just get more and more questions. And, you know, people have been saying for thousands of years that there's, you know, people have been using God as some kind of answer to some of these questions. But I mean, there's also, I think, a Sherlock Holmes quote where, you know, if you can't prove all of these other theories, then, you know, the one that remains is kind of the one that's true. And to an extent, maybe you can't prove God, but you also can't necessarily disprove God either. And so I think, you know, I think if people are trying to consider how to live a meaningful life, or considering, I don't know, even thinking, like considering a debate between science and religion, you know, I think a lot of people just discount religion by naivety, and that they don't necessarily understand what religion is about. I mean, that was certainly my perspective for many years, just because I had never really understood what religion was about or what one religion might prescribe or say about living a life.
How did you change that perspective, or what changed it?
Yeah, I started learning more about religion. Started learning.
Most people wouldn't do that. Most people wouldn't even take that step. What allowed you? How did you give yourself permission to take that step and say, "I'm going to open my mind to this and actually learn it before I make a judgment"?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think to an extent, it's probably social. Is that I saw some of my friends, you know, learning more about religion, but also, you know, I was also learning just about kind of, because if you think about a lot of value systems of society and about culture, a lot of them come back to religion, and, you know, thinking about where do these value systems actually come from, you know, and then might as well go and try to explore these myself and see what they have to say.
So if you had a friend who was hesitant to ever explore anything religious, how would you explain to them, listen, it's worth at least looking into? How would you persuade them to take a try?
Yeah, you know, I would tell them to, you know, try to find a peer that they could talk to. You know, I think finding someone who has been through the experience that, you know, didn't grow up with religion and then found it or started to learn more about it is is a, you know, it's a very empathetic feeling to find someone like that yourself, you know, someone who was in your shoes and then went through a process that, you know, some people don't really hear about. So I think trying to find someone like that, but then also just, you know, thinking about it, you know, if there's two sides of this debate, right, then there's science, religion, then, you know, you probably know the science aspect much, much more than the religious aspect. But if you don't know two sides of a debate, can you really decide the answer for yourself? No, because then you're just biased to one side. So, you know, it's also just this aspect of understanding the two sides to debate and, you know, seeing which one appeals to you more or which one you think is gets to the truth more.
You spent time in Russia. What would you say the value differences are between society here in America and Russian society? And which society actually has more of a openness to religion and God in general?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I wish I could say more. I mean, I was only there for 7 weeks and didn't get to understand too much about their values. But what, I mean, one of them that at least stuck out to me was just how in America, I think there's this attitude of individualism and that you're very unique and that, you know, you should follow that uniqueness. And, you know, the people say follow your passions and things like that. And it's kind of just all about yourself. Whereas I think in a society like Russia, it's much more community-minded. It's much more collectivist. It's much more of, you know, trying to think about how your role fits in with society and with your community. And, you know, I was talking to one of my peers who she had spent time in America, and the way she kind of described it to me is that she felt like all of her American friends were in a movie, and that they were all kind of actors in a movie playing their very individual roles. Whereas in Russia, it was very much like people have their own identity, but they just felt kind of more part of a community and more part of a society.
And just the final question, do you think American society would be better off, as you mentioned, kind of the rat race and maybe a lack of happiness? Do you think reacquainting people with these more core values would help stem that trend?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think a large part of why there's all these negative things happening in America today is because people don't really have this playbook, or they don't really understand it. And, you know, they don't really have these values for themselves. And, you know, as a result, they're kind of just stumbling through life, maybe making individual choices, but not really seeing how the bigger whole fits together, or maybe how there's a narrative of how all these values fit together. And, you know, to an extent, I mean, I went to a very Christian school, and I was pretty much the only Jewish kid in my high school. And yeah, I mean, these kids were just like very anti-Semitic at times, very prejudiced at times, would scapegoat me a lot of times. And, you know, I think to an extent, some of these people had religious teachings, but they weren't necessarily living up to the values. And so I think it has to be learning about what these religious texts say, and then actually making sure that you're trying to implement them into your life as well. And yeah, I think if people learn more about these values and try to actually make changes in their lives, then society would be a lot better as a whole. And I mean, to an extent, I think a lot of these topics relate to business as well. I mean, I'm very interested in business. And I think one of the things we've seen recently is just brands becoming very big in what a brand stands for and what a company stands for. I think a lot of that just goes back to, because there's kind of this declining sense of religion and values from religion, businesses have kind of made up for it in that consumers are now, you know, kind of attaching part of their identity to the values that a brand has. And so I think all of these things are kind of interrelated.
Totally agree. I agree. I think the vacuum as religion has faded from the scene, as a lot of other, from capitalism to other ideologies, to step in strange ways, and society is going through quite an upheaval from all that. Anyway, Daniel, thank you very much for your insights and fascinating thoughts on this very important topic, and we appreciate your perspective.
Thanks for having me.